Coming up on Life is a Festival.
Liberty caps are our indigenous medicine, and it's part of the reclamation, ultimately. A lot of people are flying all across the world for healing, for psychedelic experiences, and yet we have it right here under our feet, growing at this time of year. High doses of psilocybin mushrooms, you know, I haven't done ayahuasca, but from people who have compared, it's very similar. It's a tryptamine, you know, psilocybin and psilocin, they're part of the tryptamine family. And yeah, I've done most of my inner work on magic mushrooms, and I'm proud of that too, you know.
Welcome back to Life is a Festival. My name is Eamon Armstrong, and I am so excited to bring you a delightful episode of the show today. Things have been pretty dark lately, and I've tried to breathe a little light into the spaces that I can breathe light into through podcasts recently, but it's been a difficult time, and my hope is that this podcast, recorded before the events that unfolded in Israel, might bring a little levity to your November, or whenever you're listening to this. Because today I am speaking to Dara Stewart. Dara is a molecular biologist, a passionate advocate of Celtic mysticism and Irish culture, and the co-founder and scientific lead facilitator at Inward Bound, which is one of the world's first psychedelic retreats in the Netherlands. So I met Dara as a guest on my other podcast, the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, which, by the way, is coming back after a year of hiatus in January. And he said, if you're ever in Ireland, I want to show you around. So it just so happens that I was in Ireland for the first time. I am of Irish ancestry by way of Australia. And I was in Ireland for the very first time. And Dara offered to tour me around sacred sites in the southern part of Ireland. And we went on quite a magical adventure. And after a full day of exploring and gallivanting, and then a night of singing and enjoying the fire and just deeply submerging in all things Irish, we did a podcast. One of the great joys of doing something like Life is a Festival is that I get to meet these incredible people and learn about their lives and about their culture and about how they make their life like a festival. And Dara and I are actually super similar. We both have Irish names. We both love psychedelic healing. We both are very passionate about men's work. We're both ruggedly handsome. So anyway, on the show, Dara and I discuss the ancestral pain of the Irish, how ancient Ireland was like the Amazon. We talk about Liberty Cap psychedelic mushrooms and how they were the indigenous medicine of Ireland. We talk about a place called Dundary, the Irish School of Shamanic Studies. We discuss our journey and the adventure we took through the sacred sites of Southern Ireland. And then finally, we talk about Dara's Inward Bound psychedelic retreats in the Netherlands, which I would highly advise working with him because he's the best. Before we start the episode, I just want to say a word about Reuben Walker. Now, you, dear listener, may not have known Reuben. Some of you may have. Reuben was a dear friend and a friend to many in the world of festivals. He worked on Envision Festival in Costa Rica. Reuben died last week, and the community will be gathering in Santa Barbara to celebrate his life this weekend. And so, Reuben, this podcast is for you. This podcast is dedicated to you and to your joy and also to your struggles and also to the healing of mental health for everyone everywhere. Bless your journey, Reuben. We love you so much. And now, here is Dara Stewart.
What does the name Dara mean?
So Dara is a Gaelic name. Dara, it means oak tree. Or also loosely like druid as well, or doorway. So yeah, very happy to have that name.
Oak tree, druid, or doorway. Which of those three do you think describes you the best?
Yeah, probably the oak tree. Yeah. And in Celtic cosmology, each month actually has a tree. And I'm born in June, which is the oak tree. Mm. So there's a bit of a double drop there for me. I like the idea of the oak tree. It's one of the noble trees in the Celtic calendar. It creates a lot of biodiversity. It is very nurturing. It is strong. It's one of the strongest woods. It's very stable. And it's kind of like strength, you know? It's like expansive. Like when you come across an oak tree, you feel its power, you feel its energy. So I feel like it's nice to embody those kind of feelings.
We have these beautiful coastal oaks in California where I live. Mm-hmm. I love the power of an oak tree. Mm-hmm. Oak trees are, to me, like horses in the sense of their sturdiness and reliability. And when I think about masculinity, for me, the horse is like the symbol for me of healthy masculinity. Steady, reliable, present, but not like I like lions, I identify with lions, but not like a lion, not like ferocious, not necessarily even heroic, but just like stalwart. Mm-hmm. And I feel like an oak tree is a similar noble presence. I also have an Irish name, as you know, Eamon. Yeah. It's an Irish name, which we were just discussing last night for the listeners who likely do not know this. My name, Eamon, comes from the English Edmund, which means rich protector. And as I was sharing with you last night, I was thought that meant I was supposed to be wealthy and protect people in a sort of feudal sense. But I think of it now as the protector of the richness of life, which is a nice namesake.
Yeah, beautiful. It's a good thing to embody and live.
How Irish are you? Have you done like a 23andMe or like have you had your genes analyzed?
No. I haven't had them analyzed. It's something that's on my list of doing, especially being a I haven't done all my studies as a geneticist. My paternal line actually comes from Scotland, so my great 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 grandfather, he emigrated over here in the late 1800s. And actually, a few months ago, I went to Scotland. I found the place where he was actually born in Cumberland Street in Edinburgh. And it's now converted into a pub. But I stood outside there and then I got the family kilt as well. So I had the family tartan. And it was just amazing to see where he was born. And then he emigrated over to Ireland as a carpenter. And then my mother's line is Dublin. They were born and raised in Dublin. And that goes back, many generations. So got a bit of Scottish in there. Well, my surname is Stuart, which is a very strong Scottish name. It's one of the royal lines, I suppose, the Stuarts. The Edinburgh Castle was the Stuarts. So it's a nice blend of Irish and Scottish, very Celtic.
Something that I knew about you prior to coming here, because we met 2 years ago in the context of your work in psychedelics, something that I knew before coming here, and this is my first time in Ireland, is that Irish culture and Ireland, the land, the elements of this place, the people of this place, the history, the mysticism, the mythology, is extremely important to you. Mm. Has it always been that way, or is that something that you discovered in your life, this deep connection to place and the culture of your people?
Yeah, I feel, for me growing up, and I think like most Irish people, that it's always there in the background, so to speak. We're taught the Gaelic language from primary school, from the age of 4 or 5. The Irish language is on all the signposts, and the kind of Celtic drawing and Celtic art is always in plain sight. But it was a bit of a journey for me to really reclaim that kind of Irishness or the kind of the culture, because there's a really big stigma around the Gaelic language and a lot of Irish culture due to this kind of colonialism and this internalized shame around it that Irish people have carried due to, if you spoke the Irish language, you were generally poorer, you wouldn't get a job, you struggled. So there was like this pushback against our culture, and then more embracing like the English culture, I suppose, due to being able to work or get a job and do well in the world. So a lot of that was kind of seen as the past and let go. But in the last number of years, there's this big reclamation of our culture, our heritage, of connecting to the land, the sacred sites, our traditional music as well. And yeah, it's been a quite a beautiful journey for me to go on as well, like almost being proud of where I come from, being proud of the history, even though our Irish history is horrendous, like the things that happened here, being one of the first places colonized in the world by the British and all that came with that, you know, the famine, which was actually a genocide. The food was exported out of Ireland. The people were left to starve. All the bloody battles that happened here, all the revolutions that failed. It's quite a heavy history, and a lot of people go through that kind of ancestral suffering and ancestral pain and the pain of the land and what happened to the people here. And it's quite a challenging one to embody, and a lot of people kind of avoid it. They just don't want to go there. And I think part of the deep healing that people do in this country when they do whatever plant medicine or connect to spirituality is actually having to move through that pain of the ancestors, pain of what happened on this land. But coming out the other side, you can see how rich and beautiful our culture is, our mythology is, the music, the poetry, the writing, you know, the land of saints and scholars. And it's been a wonderful journey for me to go on that. And I see that happening for a lot of people now, especially a lot of younger generations. There's a huge resurgence in the Gaelic language. I only have cupla focal as a small few words. I'm still trying to get my head around it. It's like learning German or something for me. Some people take it on easier. Yeah, it's quite a rich tapestry of a culture that we have, and it's wonderful to be a part of the revival of it.
You know, it's interesting. I didn't really think much about the idea of an internalized, oppressive ancestral trauma as part of the Irish psyche necessarily.
Yeah,
I understand Irish culture through its diaspora. Mm-hmm. And my experience of the Irish in America is quite a lot of pride about being Irish.
Yeah.
And we have, you know, St. Patrick's Day is this time where it's like, kiss me, I'm Irish. And, you know, you're not Irish, you wear green. We have a holiday in the U.S. where we're celebrating Irish people. There's certainly stereotypes and alcohol and leprechauns, and there's like a cheesy aspect to it, certainly. Mm-hmm. But my experience of the Irish in America has been very much one of pride in Irishness. Mm. And I wasn't aware, and of course it makes sense now that you express it, and certainly with the extraordinary tragedies that have occurred in this land, that there would be this kind of mental slavery, this kind of ancestral internalization of the sins of colonization being passed down through generations, much as it has through lots of cultures that have had that experience historically.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I've only been really looking into this kind of idea of decolonization of mind, you know, and I looked at Canada and a lot of the kind of speakers and topics are going on there, and how they're reclaiming their indigenous culture now, and they're unearthing some of the literally and figuratively the skeletons of colonization in the past. And at one point it was dangerous to be Irish in Ireland. If you were speaking Irish, if you were singing Gaelic songs, if you were dancing traditional Irish dance, if you were connecting to sacred sites, like, you would probably be murdered or killed by the colonizers. So what happened was a lot of stories and folklore and songs and music all went underground. And there was what was known as hedge schools, where people used to meet in the forest and they would try and keep the culture alive by just gathering, coming together. And then they would go to whatever, the industrial schools and all that sort of thing. But a lot of people really fought hard to keep the culture alive. And the culture is the Gaelic language, and the culture is most alive out West Ireland, down here and Connemara, up around Galway. And that's the furthest away from England, you know, and it was hard to get there with the roads and everything. So those places kept a lot of that kind of Gaelic culture alive. So yeah, at one point it was dangerous to be Irish in Ireland, which is quite bizarre. But I think, you know, when Irish people left here and went to America, they had more freedom ultimately, because that was a time of freedom and expansiveness. So there was like this longing back to Ireland and the pride. And it's wonderful to see that kind of the blend there of the American and the Irish, and how really big like Ireland was in the foundation of America. So many Irish people went there, like millions, through Ellis Island. I've visited there myself and looked at the books and stood there and wondered what would have been like being an emigrant going from Ireland in the 1800s, where it was so bleak, no opportunities, to this cosmopolitan place that was just forming.
Something you said yesterday to me while we were on our grand exploration of sacred sites and going through the countryside outside of Cork, where we are now. Something you expressed to me that really caught my imagination was that Ireland used to have the biggest food forests in Europe. and you were described it as being like the Amazon in a way. It was, you know, beautiful October day, overcast, this mystical kind of little fog, you know, so green here. For the listener, if you're imagining Ireland as a green place, it is that. Like, very beautiful, lots of life and growth. And when you were describing it as kind of like the indigeneity of the Amazon in like Irish indigenous culture, Celtic people seeding these food forests and cultivating this rich biodiversity, that really captured my imagination around where we're at in the world today and how much that way of living seems to be what would make a sustainable world. And I didn't really think about Ireland that way, because you imagine it as these sort of picturesque bucolic fields, but of course it wasn't that way at all.
No, when Ireland had several waves of settlers, they reckon, and they've done some genetic tests and found that the first people had really like dark skin and blue eyes from the kind of Neolithic period. And then you had several waves of genetic influx of different populations. But the earliest populations, they would have arrived to a place that was completely covered in dense forestry. And the only way to really get in was to go down the rivers. So some of the oldest kind of sacred sites and archaeological sites are, you know, in the Boyne Valley, where the settlers landed, and then they went down the Boyne River, and then they found these areas of heightened elevation. And a lot of the first settlers were hunter-gatherers, and they would have arrived in this place that was like rich in apples, blackberries, you have all the trees, acorns, hazelnuts, similar to the United States. I read recently that a lot of the United States was covered in hazelnut trees, and that was the primary food source for people there. But when people started to settle, started to clear fields, to farm, and then over subsequent generations, more land was cleared. But the big clearing kind of happened in the era of Cromwell, when they started to cut a lot of the forests down to build the British Navy. So they exported a lot of the wood and the trees. So Ireland went from a place that was nearly probably 100% covered in native woodland to one of the lowest now in Europe, apparently. And there's projects now, the Gaelic Woodland Project, where people are buying land and fields and starting to plant native trees again for biodiversity. And there was mismanagement as well of land. We saw it yesterday on our walk. You have these Sitka spruce plantations of fast-growing trees, so densely packed together, which creates acidic soil, no biodiversity. So a lot of that was lost. But yeah, it's a wonderful time now because there is an awareness around it. So people are starting to plant like native trees and rebuild these kind of sustainable ecosystems, which is really wonderful. But yeah, I look at fields and I see empty fields and I think, wow, we could be growing so much there in a kind of permaculture sustainable way. And that's what I feel our ancestors would have done. They didn't have supermarkets, so this is how they did it. And it's quite like in the Amazon, that like what I was reading recently, that the Amazon was mostly planted by humans over many generations. They knew where to plant different species of fruits and produce to be able to go there and collect it and leave it for the next generation.
So in the Amazon, one of the things that they planted was ayahuasca vines.
Yeah.
Which of course we love. I was surprised that you have not yet done ayahuasca, which makes me want to do ayahuasca with you.
Yeah, great.
I'm a big fan of that. But Ireland has its native psychedelic plant. Mm. And I want to talk a bit about that. So the Liberty mushrooms, what is your understanding of how these mushrooms have been a part of the evolution of Celtic culture and mysticism, and how have they brought us to today? You know, we love psychedelics and the way in which psychedelics have blossomed in cultures. And I had no idea that Ireland was so connected to these mushrooms, but it really is. And that is delightful to me.
Yeah. And this is another part of the revival. And I'm really, I suppose, at the vanguard with regards to that. Psilocybe semilanceata grows all across Ireland at this time of year. And I feel our ancestors would have had such a deep understanding of herbalism. They would have had a strong connection to all plants, all fungi. And I really feel that they were using them in a probably in a recreational way, because Irish people are great fun, great crack. But I feel that they were also using them in a ceremonial and sacred way. We have little clues there in the folklore. We always have these depictions of little people under mushrooms and magical people around mushrooms. But these mushrooms are one of the strongest kind of strains of mushrooms, psilocybe semilancia. And I've tried many different types of strains, and there's always a different quality to taking those mushrooms. Now, maybe it's a set and setting, but people even talk about if you take mushrooms from a sacred site in Ireland, they're stronger than if you just take them from a random field. And people talk about different kind of strengths across, or different experiences across different kind of vintages. But it's very tricky because the archaeological record doesn't really show much use of mushrooms, because all you have to do is pick them and eat them. There's no like crazy apparatus to make them or to process them. But we can look to some of the kind of early cave art and see that some of the like the patterns are very reminiscent of the patterns that you might see when you take high doses of these mushrooms and close your eyes. And then also there's been my colleague Rob has seen mushroom kind of carvings inside some sacred sites in the Boyne Valley. And yeah, I feel that the Druids, you know, which these were like the priestly class, the intelligentsia of the time, the learned ones who held the law, who held the religion of the time, so to speak, like the paganism, more than likely, they were the ones that were probably taking the high doses, very similar to shamans. They would have taken the high doses, connected to nature, connected to spirit, connected to something greater, and helped to like mediate for people or work with people's illness. Also in Ireland as well, we had a very strong tradition of sweat lodges or sweat houses. So these were stone structures. People would have gone inside with hot stones to sweat. And more than likely, they were taking high doses of mushrooms and going in there to sweat as a kind of a healing process, similar to what happens in Mexico or Native American culture. And then unfortunately, when the Irish culture was being decimated, these kind of places of healing were central points of the community. So a lot of them were destroyed in the Cromwell era as well. But we still have a lot of remnants of them, especially out the west coast. The likes of Leitrim has the highest density of these huts. Tig Alias, I think that's what it's called, sweat house or healing house. So yeah, I definitely feel that they were a central part of our ancestors' kind of medicinal toolkit. But a lot of the lineages were broken. A lot of the knowledge was lost. I think it goes with the decimation of the Druids, the decimation of witches or folk healers, and then the stigma came. So there's like a big stigma in this country with mushrooms in general. A lot of people don't eat mushrooms, even culinary mushrooms, because they're like, oh no, they're disgusting, they're dangerous, or there's kind of like this pushback.
Not even culinary mushrooms.
Well, they do now a lot, but we're not a big mushroom country, you know? Mm. I found it really funny because when a lot of people from Eastern Europe came here, they were the ones out foraging mushrooms. I'm like, why there's no Irish people? Why is there not many Irish people foraging mushrooms? It just wasn't like part of our kind of culture. But yeah, nearly if you always go out, even now still, and see people foraging mushrooms, they're almost like Eastern European or from the continent. It's just not, part of our culture really, this kind of mycology, so to speak. But there's a big rise in people wanting to pick magic mushrooms, of course. And that's a big part of my work, you know, educating around safely consuming magic mushrooms and identifying them and harm reduction, setting intentions and doing it in a sacred way. And this is mainly down to the media and all the research around depression, anxiety, and then people realizing, wow, there's free psychedelic substances up in the mountains. So why not go out and pick some and enjoy them? So yeah, I really feel that, you know, Liberty Caps are our indigenous medicine, and it's part of the reclamation, ultimately. A lot of people are flying all across the world for healing, for psychedelic experiences, and yet we have it right here under our feet, growing at this time of year. High doses of psilocybin mushrooms, you know, I haven't done ayahuasca, but from people who have compared, it's very similar. You know, it's a tryptamine, psilocybin and psilocin, they're part of the tryptamine family. And yeah, I've done most of my inner work on magic mushrooms, and I'm proud of that too, you know. But yeah, ayahuasca will be in the cards at some point in the future when the time is right.
Dara means oak tree. It also means druid. Do you think that maybe you're a bit of a modern druid in a way, Dara, in your work with psychedelics and healing?
Yeah, well, I'm definitely not so sure on that. I do like to embody the mysticism and this kind of esoteric sort of way of looking in the world. I think that my science part has a little bit resistance to that, you know. But there's also like a big reclamation of druidry in this country as well. I think there's a druidic society, which I haven't been involved yet with, but it's there on the periphery for me. I've been definitely more drawn to like world shamanism, and my training with Dundari and Martin Duffy, you know, has really shown me how a lot of these different techniques and practices across all cultures solidify into very similar things: becoming present, working with the subconscious mind, working with the drum, working with trance-induced states of consciousness, and, you know, working with death as an ally, working on empowering yourself for your own healing and not looking outside of yourself for healing. So yeah, a lot of my training in shamanic practice has really helped inform my work with psychedelics, because unfortunately we don't have the cultural context here to work with psychedelics, whereas in like the Shabibo or the Huniquin or the Bwiti, they have their whole culture, they have their whole thing that they do. But here now we're working with magic mushrooms in a bit of a blind way. I suppose we can look to the lineage of Maria Sabina in Oaxaca and this kind of thing. And my colleague Rob has also like really pointed out a lot of similarities between the writings of Maria Sabina and her lineage and old Gaelic texts, drawn these kind of like parallels of the mysticism and whether there was maybe a link there. So yeah, I think it's a really fascinating time to like almost rebuild a cultural context now for use of psilocybin mushrooms, and then also like honor the past, honor other cultures as well. You know, I think we are learning so much from other cultures, but we don't need to like be other cultures. I think I feel like a lot of people in the plant medicine community go to somewhere like Sacred Valley and then they take on a name, they're wearing all the like local clothes, they, you know, using all the local herbs. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but I think people should look a little bit deeper into what they have in their own place of origin. And I think it's a really exciting time, because we have access to mushrooms here all across the land, and other countries have their own indigenous medicine too. So we were talking a little bit about that yesterday around these kind of central hotspots of healing, and they're all across the world. And I think we need to have these hotspots in every country, or at least within a little bit more short of a distance, if we're going to like tackle climate change and travel and stuff.
You just mentioned Dundari and Martin Duffy. Mm-hmm. You said you were doing work with Dundari and Martin Duffy.
Yeah, so Dundari is like the Irish school of shamanic studies. And yeah, Martin and Annette, they have been holding the course on Celtic shamanism for nearly 30 years, I think. Martin's done a lot of work with different medicines over the years. He's been in many different shamanic cultures. He runs a transpersonal therapist training. He did work with Stanislav Grof, and he's kind of the OG here in Ireland. He is the elder. He's one of the elders that we have, which is really wonderful. And that's a whole issue in itself, missing elders in the space because of the kind of the disconnection and the cutoff that we had. So these elders are there, and they're coming true and stepping more into that space to support people like me in my work. So I'm very thankful to my elders and my mentors. I have a bunch of them, which is great.
It's good to have a bunch of mentors. You can't just have one. You got to have like a smattering of different mentors.
Yeah. I have my mentor with psychedelics. I have my
A board of directors to come in and be like, we've all talked about it and you need to stop doing the bad thing. Like,
okay. Yeah.
Well, you all said to do it, I'll do it.
Yeah. And I had this conversation with one of my friends the other day. I don't think everything can be in one person. I'd have a mentor I talk about sexuality with. I'd have a mentor I talk about men's work with. One about plant medicine. One about shamanism. And I feel very fortunate, you know?
We like all the same things.
Yeah. Go figure.
We are into all the same things.
Yeah. So it's a really wonderful place. I'd love to take you there next time and even to meet Martin. He does fantastic work, but it's all very grounded work. He was a psychiatric nurse in the system for many years, and he worked with people in very distressing states. But now his kind of philosophy is really welcoming the weird and welcoming the people that feel like they don't fit in, the black sheeps, and allowing people to express that part of themselves, that they might have intuition, that they might have this deeper connection to land or to the supernatural or to beings, or would be highly sensitive as well. I would definitely class myself as a highly sensitive person, especially after doing vipassanas and plant medicine. I think it gets the spidey senses going. But, you know, a lot of people are born like that, you know, and then it's cut off, it's shut down. They're seen as like different or weird and it's suppressed. So I think those spaces are really welcoming everything, which is really beautiful.
Yeah, the idea of sensitivity, you know, to be sensitive is to be strong. Mm. I'm a highly sensitive person, as anyone who knows me and has borne witness to my drama. There's a book called The Drama of the Gifted Child that is about this sort of matter of this kind of highly sensitive being. And it's quite a journey to hold that and to be in the space of having that sort of repressed by the forces that repress us all everywhere, the forces of control, and then to rediscover that sensitivity as strength, and then find that from that sensitivity, we're actually in a position where we can be supportive to the healing of others. I think that's a very common path for many people, whether that lands you in a position of artist or a position of healer. There's that sensitivity that once you wished you could blunt because it was very painful and difficult, ultimately becomes your superpower later.
Yeah.
I'm sure many of the listeners can identify with having that experience. In the introduction to this podcast, the listener will become familiar a bit with your background and who you are and what you're doing. One of the things that I've found so fascinating about you and your connection to shamanism, mysticism, et cetera, is that you're also a PhD molecular biologist. I love the way the science and the spiritual interweave in your life, because we need both. Mm-hmm. We need two eyes to see through the veil. In my opinion, now I don't know if someone is listening and says, no, I'm purely a witch. But I think we do need both to navigate this modern world. And so with that in mind, I want to talk a bit about you. And that's kind of setting the table. But the first question I would ask is, when's the first time you ate an Irish mushroom?
Great question. Yeah, the first time I ate Irish mushroom.
Well, really any mushroom. My presumption is that it would be an Irish one first, but I want it to be an Irish one.
Yeah, first. It was definitely an Irish one first. I think it must be nearly 10 years ago now. Yeah, the first kind of mushroom psychedelic experience I had.
Had you finished university at that point?
Had I finished university? Well, I was in university for 10 years. I did undergraduate 4 years and the PhD and then postdoc. So yeah, I would have been still there. Yeah, it was quite a pivotal moment for me, my first magic mushroom experience. I hadn't done any substances until my mid-20s. My first experience was with MDMA in a club, which was one of the most profound experiences I've ever had. I'd say it was like my quote-unquote awakening, so to speak. I got massive therapeutic value from it straight away, and I understood the therapeutic nature of substances like straight away. And then that led me into 2CB. And
love 2CB. 2CB to me is like the easiest one. It's like dear listener, everyone responds to substances differently, so perhaps 2CB is not your medicine. I love it. It's so gentle on my mind. It doesn't take me sideways. Anyway, just a big shout out to 2CB and Alexander Shulgin.
Yeah, absolutely. And for me, what I got from it was this deep sense of being able to have introspection in a really beautiful way. And I felt like most phenethylamines, they're quite compassionate. Similar to, you know, MDMA, you can have a lot of self-love. So a lot of my early psychedelic work was on learning to love myself. And I kind of went into what I was reading at the time and consuming.
What were you reading at the time?
I read books like, Learn to Love Yourself, Gay Hendricks, a lot of Thich Nhat Hanh, You Are Here, Alan Watts. Of course, The Power Now was in there, some of these kind of pivotal books. But when I had psilocybin mushrooms, I just could not believe the stories that I've been told of drugs are bad and stay away from them and don't do them, and the stigma around it and psychedelics and being hippie and all this kind of like negative load that I really started to question, you know, who built this narrative for me? You know, it wasn't my parents. It was more just like the societal narrative of, you know, addiction as well and druggy. And there is a big drug problem in Ireland with heroin still. And there was in the 80s in Ireland, there was a big wave of heroin overuse and a lot of deaths and really big scourge on Irish society in the 80s. So there is that societal load there. Being able to have that experience with something natural for the first time because I had MDMA, TCP, not quote unquote natural. But, you know, being able to have something from the earth that is so pure and to take it and have a connection to the land and to have an altered state of consciousness through it and ultimately feel that it's healing and beneficial was so profound for me. I was like, why isn't everybody doing this? There's so much depression and anxiety in the world. And for me, I was suffering with depression and anxiety in university. I had a really, really tough breakup. I was with a girl for 10 years. We broke up, then my grandmother died. So she was the closest person to me that had died in my reality. So I went into this kind of big existential sort of like, what's the point of everything? Seeing this person I love in front of me dying in suffering. She died in a lot of suffering. And then the breakup of having this like death of a relationship and this kind of like, who am I now without this relationship and this kind of identity crisis? And then in the middle of my PhD studies, and this all kind of compounded into this really dark, depressive place for me where I was in a really tough spot. And then the kind of the golden light at the end of it was, you know, moving into meditation, yoga and psychedelics and magic mushrooms. I know that magic mushrooms healed me. That's what I really feel. Of course, I do my own healing, but having them as an ally and having them as an aid, I was able to get back on track. I was able to start to do like the little things again. I had started to get passion, curiosity for life. It kind of like lit the fire again, really got the fire going for me again. And yeah, I'm profoundly grateful for coming across them.
Mm. You know, it's such an interesting common story, that one. I don't want to say common, but it's such a beautiful story. That journey that you're highlighting is one that many of us have walked, yeah. And it seems to have some similar features. I had done psychedelics and recreationally, and I'd partied and that sort of thing. For me, it was ayahuasca, and it was coming out of a breakup. I ended an engagement and was just didn't know which way was up. And it was ayahuasca, reading Alan Watts and starting to meditate. And it's this idea that we have authorship of our own healing. We have authorship of our own growth and life and identity. And I think that one of the great maladies of this alienated modern life is this powerlessness that so many people feel. And we are powerless against these large economic and historical forces that kind of push us into little boxes. And then we're powerless around our own health, particularly our mental health. Mm-hmm. And there's something about the journey of psychedelics and that kind of healing that is this sort of revivification mm-hmm. of our sense of possibility.
Absolutely. And I think for me, what I really recognized very early was I was using psychedelics to feel, where most substances at the time I was taking was to numb. And I think that is huge in Irish culture, where we have this kind of idea that if you're taking drugs, you're trying to escape and you're trying to numb yourself. Where my early experiences were on really feeling. And in that feeling, I found a lot of healing. And for me, that was incredible. I was able to feel a lot and have some pretty big cathartic releases early on of shame and guilt and anger and just been able to release. And for me, I saw such a clear path in I need to share this with the world. I want to aid in other people's experience just like I have had. And how can we do that in a safe, ethical and in like a way of with a good integrity and from the heart. And that's, yeah, I suppose, the journey that I've still been on. And very lucky that, you know, magic mushrooms grow all across Ireland and we don't have to fly all across the world, or we don't have to work with all the negative aspects of prohibition where you don't know what you're getting and you don't know the substance, you don't know the strain and you don't know the quality. I think the whole war on drugs, you know, we talked a lot about that yesterday. I'm sure you've shared a lot about it on your podcast, but you know, how it just doesn't make sense. You know, it doesn't make any logical or rational sense.
It makes sense if you understand what the goals of it are.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't make sense if you think it's about keeping people safe, because it's absolutely insane if you think that it's about keeping people safe. But that's not what the drug war is. It's a mechanism of control, and not in some sort of like vague conspiracy sense. Like it really is the policies of the Nixon administration, the policies of the kind of global drug war around American neocolonialism. Like it's very textbook control. And it's so interesting too, if you look at like what the British were doing in Ireland and then what the heirs of that imperialism in America are doing in Latin America, and using the prohibition of cultural substances as a way of controlling and oppressing mm-hmm. local people and cultures and divorcing them from their methods of healing and their methods of connection and their methods of mysticism. And because at the end of the day, if you are trying to dominate a people, you want to separate them. You want to keep them separate, keep them unhealthy. So of course, the drug war makes absolutely zero sense if you look at what it says it's trying to do.
Yeah.
But what it is really, the agenda is really there. It makes a lot of sense that people who are trying to maintain certain structures want to maintain something like that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then coming back to the point around my training as a scientist had wired my brain in a different way. And I was able to really get stuck into the academic research then and really start looking at all the kind of work in the 60s and the work of Stan Grof and some of these big pioneers. I really started to throw myself into, you know, what's been going on here and looking at, I'm probably really fortunate, you know, all the studies in Imperial College started to come out then when I was getting interested and it was really kind of like, whoa, things are really, really picking up again. Is it a coincidence, you know, I start doing psychedelics when things start picking up again? I don't know. But I think being able to approach psychedelics in a very therapeutic sense early on was massively beneficial to my life. Now, don't get me wrong, I think psychedelics are great fun. And I see there's three kind of ways to work with psychedelics. There's the recreational festivals. People can get massive healing from that, healing on the dance floor, healing in community. You have the big festivals, Boom, Burning Man, Azora, where people come together as a community and support one another and create safety and have these amazing altered states of consciousness together. Then you have the healing aspect where people are coming to retreats like mine for like depression, anxiety, PTSD, trauma, grief, and this sort of thing. And then you have the entheogenic experience where people want to like meet God, ego dissolution, feel this oceanic boundlessness or this oneness. And in all of these kind of ways, there is deep healing, but there's also the psychonautical aspect of, you know, exploring the final frontier, which is our own mind. And I think that's quite really beautiful for a lot of people. And early on in my journey, I was able to really feel all aspects because I had all of those experiences pretty quickly, mystical experiences. And as a scientist, having a mystical experience was like, whoa, I don't know anything that's going on. I thought I knew what was going on. I'm humble to you, life, again. And even now I'm continually humbled. The more questions I know, the more questions I want to ask. And I think that's just the curiosity of a science brain probably. And yeah, I just love facilitating and having those conversations with people around their psychedelic experiences and being a little bit further on the path. It's always a beautiful journey to walk it and to aid others on that, but knowing that there's so many roads ahead of me that I have no idea. So it's always humbling myself to the medicine, to the consciousness of those substances. And yeah.
So Dara, you are an oak tree. You are a druid in ways. You're also a doorway. Let's talk about what we did yesterday.
Yeah.
So you took me to one of the sacred sites in Southern Ireland, a circle of stones, and took me on a bit of a journey around Ireland and showed me some things. And you presented certain things to me that were quite meaningful. And you did it specifically through the elements, mm-hmm. through connecting with the land. And it's exactly what I wanted, by the way. it's like that's exactly the type of experience that I was looking for, is this way of connecting to place. So you're a scientist. You are someone who is deeply studied in ways of expanding consciousness and ways of connecting with certain things. I'm curious about the choices that you made to take me to certain places, to have certain experiences as a way of connecting to the land. And I'm wondering if we can speak about that in a way that can allow our listeners to, in kind of a sense, have gone on the journey with us, to give them a little insight into what it might mean to connect with the mysticism of this green land.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, I think there's so much magic here in Ireland. And I find it really unfortunate that, you know, most tourists come in, they fly into Dublin, they do the Dublin thing, they go up to Galway and they get this kind of sanitized version of what we really have here. So I wanted to give you a bit more of an authentic wild experience, a magical experience. And yeah, no better way than to connect into some of the power places here in Ireland, the sacred sites and sacred places. a lot of them are in ruins, as you've seen, which is really unfortunate. And there's kind of big movements at the moment to restore some of these sacred sites and preserve them, especially up in the Boyne Valley. There's some of the chambers, the cairns, which we'll go to next time for sure, Newgrange and Loch Crew, these amazing sites that align with different astronomical events. The solstice, the winter solstice, where the light shines in the chamber and illuminates the chamber. Newgrange, the equinox, the Loch Crew, where the light shines in and illuminates the chamber. And you see all the inscriptions and the motifs are illuminated. That area has the oldest amount of Neolithic art in the world.
Mm.
So it's amazing to see these kind of patterns and motifs. Or you have Fort Knox as well, not too far away, which has, I think, one of the earliest depictions of a human face, so they say, and these amazing zigzag patterns on the rocks. But yeah, bringing you down here west, you know, I think for me, west of Ireland really is really elemental. And in pagan culture, I think they were deeply connected to the elements and the wisdom of the elements. And this is something that I've been exploring in my own life. I'm a big fan of John O'Donohue, the writer, the poet, you know, and he talks a lot about connection to place, connection to the elements, to understand deep wisdom in yourself. And it's quite an indigenous thing. You know, if you look to other indigenous cultures, how they have deep reverence to nature and nature-based spirituality, how they look for guidance in nature, you know, Aboriginal cultures, Native American cultures, the Amazonian cultures, how they see like different animals as an expression of the jungle, pointing you in the right direction as different signs. And I think that's the same here. And that's what I'm most fascinated about now. And it's quite like far from science, which makes me even more excited, is this kind of esoteric mysticism in the signs and the symbols that we have in the land, in the elements, in different places. So I wanted to give you a little bit of that, you know, and connecting this into the sacred site, you know, doing some shamanic drumming, opening a space, honoring ancestors, welcoming in the elements, welcoming power animals, trying to create a space where everything is welcome and getting out of the conscious, rational mind and more into this like intuitive feeling space, trying to slow down, trying to be still, trying to be quiet, listening to the land, listening to the land speak. What does it have to offer us? What are the signs, the symbols, the feelings? What can a place evoke? And I think this is why Ireland has one of the highest number of literary Nobel Prize winners, is because the inspiration and the insights and the creativity that can be generated up through the land is amazing when we're open to it. And when we actually stop and slow down and quieten the mind and really feel into a place. So yeah, we went on a bit of a journey, you know, connecting to earth. So first we really were in a place of grounding, the stone circle, connected to the medicine of the earth, of the land. Yeah, I'm welcoming that kind of as an anchoring point. And then we had a beautiful hike through nature, through some native woodland, and then out to the sea, the power of the ocean, the water. We didn't get in, it was a little bit too cold and it might have been a bit beyond your capacity for the day, but that's fine. But there's great medicine in the cold, great medicine in the sea. Sea swimming in Ireland's become really popular since the pandemic. A lot of people started to jump into the sea, and there's actually men's groups now set up around, Blue Balls it's called, set around sea swimming and daily sea swimming and how good that is for the mental health and being in the elements. We know water is cleansing, salt water as well, specifically it's good for energetic clearing. And then we had the wind, we went up to see the cliffs and really feel the full elemental force of
such
of the
intense wind. Yeah. Wow, that was indeed weathering.
Yeah, that's
so weathering.
Absolutely. And then we finished the evening with the fire, and the fire is a central point in a lot of Irish households. And I'm very lucky that my house has a beautiful fire, and we had a sing song, and we had what I feel is like true connection last night. All of us sitting here and connecting, sharing stories. And the fire is so central in a lot of pagan cultures. It is a direct connection to spirit and can burn what we don't want. And it can be quite a beautiful experience to, you know, really sit around, gather around a fire. It's a focal point. It's an anchoring point. So yeah, it was a beautiful journey to go on with you and to show you like a piece of authentic Ireland, real Ireland. We were out yesterday and there wasn't any, we met barely any people. And I was like, yeah, this is what it's like to live out west. You have all of these wonderful beaches, forest, nature to yourself. And even further out west, like I was saying, there's, you know, really magical places, Bear Peninsula, Mizzenhead, Dunlop Castle, what feel like the edge of the world. It's at the edge of Europe. And then you have where Star Wars was filmed, Skellig, the Skellig Islands, where Christian monks used to stay and meditate because of the power of that place. No wonder they went out there and they stayed there and built houses and huts and meditated and probably did ritual and really went in, because these places have such a potent energy. And I think a big part of my work is resensitizing myself to life, resensitizing myself to the world, to the land. And like I was saying earlier, psychedelics help in that sense, in to be able to feel deeply. And yeah, what better way to be on the land and feel it?
Well, I am deeply grateful. What an extraordinary experience. And my first time coming to Ireland, and I have Irish ancestors down the line through Australia, Irish convicts in Australia. My name is Irish. So 2 years ago, when you were like, come to Ireland, I'll show you around, I was like, well, yes, that's definitely what I want to do. And I feel very grateful for that. And I feel very grateful to have gone on that journey with you and to feel just the experience that you have and the stewardship that you have of not only these medicines and this way of being, this culture, this place, but also your work in masculinity, mm-hmm. mental health, and so many different facets. I really felt, yeah, quite a beautiful connection with you. So it's a joy to have done that and then to have this conversation with you today to share things. You actually do offer some deep healing that is publicly available, mm-hmm. and that happens in the Netherlands, which is where you can have a business that supports healing. Inward Bound as a retreat program is one of the premier psychedelic medicine programs in the world. As soon as things get legal in Ireland, I can't wait for you to open up just this fully like mystical, elemental healing center in Ireland. And I know that's happening. I would give it like 5-10 years. We'll see. But for now, you're doing this work in the Netherlands. And I'd love for you to share a bit about it so that our listeners who are feeling a connection to you and to the work that you're doing may want to plug into that. And I'm aware that you've done some stuff there that are like psychedelic medicine retreats specifically for different cohorts, like men's retreats with psilocybin, private individual stuff for people who have really specific needs, and then also these monthly marquee 5-day retreats. So share a little bit about Inward Bound so that our listeners can potentially consider this if they are looking to do some psychedelic medicine.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And yeah, that's ultimately the vision. I want to be working here in Ireland with my indigenous medicine. So the vision is a fully integrated retreat center here where people can come and have high dose experiences with medicine that they've maybe even picked themselves, you know, and have the whole process done in a very intentional, sacred and ceremonial way, from the field to the experience. I think that'd be a beautiful thing to be able to do and to be able to offer people, and to have all the bells and whistles there around it too. So yeah, in the Netherlands, we have the retreat, and it's quite a blend of a holistic and a psychotherapeutic approach. Rob, my co-founder, is a transpersonal therapist and psychotherapist. And then with me bringing in the science and the holistic, we've really created an amazing broad spectrum program that really helps people to get the most from their psychedelic experience. You know, a lot of people can take a high dose of mushrooms themselves or with a friend or whatever, but I really feel, and the research also shows it too, that if you have the correct preparation and the correct integration, that the experience isn't just then a peak experience. It can actually be quite a meaningful, pivotal experience that can create a lot of positive behavioral change or work through whatever it is that you're looking to improve or work on or change about yourself. So yeah, so the program has about 4 hours of contact before you come on the retreat. There's a really in-depth kind of screening process. We're in a fortunate position now that we actually turn away a lot of people just based on, or we can turn away people based on, we don't think they're ready. Maybe they need to do more psychological prep, or maybe it's just not the right time. As we know, psychedelic medicines aren't for everybody, and they aren't for everybody at different times as well. If you've gone through a big grief or something like that, it's nice to have a bit of a cooling off period. So yeah, there's like a preparation program, and then the retreat is centered around 2 high doses of psilocybin truffles. And we have meditation, yoga, breath work, psychic dance, cacao ceremony, group processing circles. And we also bring in some of the Celtic mysticism as well, you know, connection to nature, shamanic drumming. Yeah, different practices to help awaken people's own sense of who they are and their culture and their healing. And ultimately, the medicine is connection. The medicine is connection to self. connection to the group and the connection to nature. So that's our kind of motto at Inward Bound. That's what we envision to help people embody at the end of the retreat experience. And then after, there's integration. There's probably about four contact hours of integration after, workshops, group processing circles, one-to-one. And then we have an amazing team of different facilitators. We have facilitators that have gone down the ketamine hypnosis route, Bufo, ayahuasca, mushrooms, holistic healing, breathwork, yoga, meditation. And we have a beautiful interdisciplinary team that really contribute to the magic. And I really feel that this work needs an interdisciplinary team. It's not just about me. I can only offer so much. But when we come together as a team where there's the sum of our parts, and that's where the real co-creation and the magic happens, is when you have a team of people who are really there in their hearts, offering a compassionate, loving, kind space. And I think that's what really makes us really special, is this kind of the personal nature. We only take 13 participants on each retreat. We're pretty strict by that. We have, you know, four facilitators on each retreat. So we're very much there with everybody for the 5 days. And we really ask people to lean on us and ask for help. And we try and offer as much of that kind of compassionate, loving support as we can.
Beautiful. So that's happening in the Netherlands, and we'll have links in the show notes. So if you, dear listener, are like, I would like to do a legal psilocybin healing retreat. Amsterdam is one of the places in the world one can do that. Jamaica is another one. I think there's some places in Mexico.
Costa Rica as well. We've opened up some retreats in Costa Rica now in January, February, and March. So
cool. Okay, so Costa Rica as well. But really, we want you to be able to do it in Ireland.
Of course. I mean,
well, when legalization happens, I've got some investors that I'm sure would be happy to be supportive. I mean, because it's that to me, and we spoke about this yesterday, is the answer to most things is going to be bioregional as we move through this next process of human civilization. From my own experience here, there is a really deep connection with the land. Mm-hmm. We talk about set and setting in a psychedelic experience as something that we can control, and we want to control so we can have a good psychedelic experience. So this, we want to have the right mindset to go in. We want to be in a setting that is safe, and you know, we control it to make it safe. But what about the setting that is out of our control, i.e. taking medicinal fungi, a medicinal plant, taking it in its place, mm-hmm. being with it in its place. There's a humility and a surrendering to place, mm-hmm. that aside from doing iboga in Africa, I haven't actually done that. I haven't been in the Amazon, although that's coming up, certainly. But to be in this experience of place, there is a kind of wisdom that comes through that I don't find in other kinds of journeys, in other kinds of explorations. And obviously, our journey was set up to be that. So mm-hmm. I think it would have been a little different if I was just kind of like waddling around on my own and some windswept beach. Be a little bit different. But the place is so profound, and to learn about the place and to feel, you know, I've got Celtic blood mm-hmm. in here, and to feel that activated by this place has a certain kind of healing. And it's all three of the things: the recreation, the healing, and the spiritual expansiveness. It is all three mm-hmm. concurrently. Mm-hmm. And sometimes our doorway is through healing or through the festival or through mm-hmm. whatever it is. But these little mushrooms have minds of their own, and mm-hmm. they will take you on the journey that they wish to take you on. Mm-hmm. So you better show up with a bit of humility and a bit of surrender. And if you do, they're ultimately kind tricksters. Mm-hmm. I hate to talk about leprechauns here with you, buddy, but if I think about a leprechaun, it kind of is a fucking liberty cap mushroom.
Yeah, it's really archetypal, isn't it? This trickster nature and the leprechaun. I think it's an archetypal energy that we have here in Ireland. This kind of trickster, messer, having the crack, kind of boisterous, and can drop great wisdom in a funny, humorous way, you know. And that's kind of like Irish culture in a nutshell. You know, we're a very humorous culture. We love having a laugh. We love having a joke. We love pretending. We love messing. We love having a slagging or a poking, you know. Who was the most cleverest person in the king's court? Well, it was the jester, you know. He could do whatever he wanted. He could say whatever he wanted to the king and everyone would laugh. But he could lay it on hard, you know.
Dara, our time has come to an end because I have to go to the airport and get on a plane and leave this beautiful green land. But thank you so much for being such an extraordinary host and for serving me your father's Guinness brown bread and taking me around this beautiful land and allowing me to have such a insight into your culture and your mind. Mm-hmm. And I'm a fan. I'm a fan of you. I'm a fan of your work. I'm excited to see it continue to blossom. And I'm grateful that we have people like you all around the world as the vanguard of this revolution in health and connectivity and consciousness. And it's great to know you, and it's a real pleasure to be with you here.
Oh, thank you so much, Gur Magat, as we say in Ireland. Thank you. And yeah, it's been a pleasure to be a kind of a custodian of the land and to share my indigenous medicine with you and to be part of the kind of revival and owning of our culture again. So thank you.
Blessings, my brother.
Many blessings.
Thank you for joining us for Life is a Festival. If you liked the show, you can support it by sharing it with your friends, following it on Spotify, or reviewing it on iTunes. If you'd like to get more involved, you can join our Facebook group, Life is a Festival, where we talk about the show and you can suggest new guests. If you really liked the show and maybe want a little bit more, visit my digital tip jar at patreon.com/lifeisafestival.com. Whatever you do, I hope today's podcast helped you make your life just a little bit more like a festival, and I'll see you on the dance floor.